Kadosh. Remember, remember, Adonai Eloheinu.
Welcome to Romamu, an open-hearted Jewish community and house of worship, learning, and spiritual growth. You're listening to Romamu's podcast, where we share words of Torah, insights, and inspiration from Romamu clergy. Thank you for being with us.
I don't know about you, but I've been noticing that the days are getting longer and the trees are starting to bud, and I've even been seeing crocuses peeking out from the soil. And somehow that's lifting me up a little bit despite endless sadness and fear in the world. But I didn't come here to talk about the weather. Or maybe I did. If you hang on until the end, you'll find out if I did or if I didn't. What I really want to talk about tonight is God. I've been teaching Torah for a long time, since the 90s, even when I was a rabbinical student. And almost in every single one of my classes, someone complains about God. Right? They get really upset because God in the Torah, I mean, let's face it, gets angry, is punishing. I mean, you remember the flood back in Genesis. You remember what happens after the golden calf and 3,000 people are killed for that sin. You remember that Moses hit a rock instead of speaking to it, and God said, you can't come into the promised land. So people get really upset in my classes about God. Like, why does God get so angry? And why is God such a punishing God? And I do my best to address my students' questions and their anger and their disappointment. But to be honest, I can't deny it. It's true. God in the Torah has an anger management problem. No doubt. It's an issue that God's beloved prophet Moshe gets in the way of again and again. Maybe after all, a prophet in Judaism is a kind of therapist for God. Moshe effectively says repeatedly, no, God, please don't destroy this people. You don't have to destroy an entire people and start over with me. You can go on with your project, even if your people are disappointing. Go on with this paltry, fledgling nation. Keep your promise, God. Stick to it. Despite your project not turning out as you planned, as you imagined. But the truth is, even though I'm a rabbi, I have not been appointed to be God's defender. Because first of all, God needs no defense, and certainly does not need my defense. And second of all, my feeling, which has gotten stronger over time, is that God of the Torah gets a bad rap. Maybe even, I would say, a terrible rap, an undeserved rap. What do I mean? So think about it. God is understandably disappointed again and again. God gave Adam and Eve exactly one command, one, and they disobey it. Okay, you could say they were set up. There was that tree in the middle of the garden. Don't touch it, right? But you could also say they were given a simple test and they failed miserably. And then during the generation of the flood, Dor HaMabul, only imagine how it was for God after creating this beautiful, majestic world of endless beauty to have people destroy it. As it says in chapter 6 of Genesis, Vayar Elohim et ha'aretz v'hineh nishchata ki hishchit kol basar et darko al ha'aretz. God saw the earth and here and had gone to ruin, for all flesh had ruined its way upon the earth. So this Hebrew word, this Hebrew verb, this root that's used for ruin is really interesting. Shin, chet, taf. It means ruin or to destroy. God creates a world of exquisite beauty, and the very creatures that are sustained by it destroy it. How depressing is that? We in our times know exactly how depressing that is, because we live with that sadness. But somehow, God finds comfort in Noah. And somehow, God builds a new world from him and his family and the animals he saved in the ark. And God finds a way to continue to rebuild. But then, there's the Israelite family. Wow, they're a mess. I mean, some people say they're dysfunctional, but I actually think it's far worse than that. They are lying,
stealing, duplicitous, name it, they've got it. But God continues with this miserable family, sending them into slavery, maybe in the hopes of reform. But even after God liberates them from slavery and splits the Red Sea and reveals God's self at Sinai, they remain a miserable, complaining people, complaining their way through 40 years in the desert. God stick with this project of bringing an impossible people to the promised land. Okay, you might be wondering, what does it have to do with our Parsha, right? We're now in the midst of two portions that are all about the building of the Mishkan, the building of the sanctuary, which is God's home on earth. It starts with these words, V'yedaber Adonai el Moshe lemor. This is last week's Parsha. Now, Adonai spoke to Moshe saying, Daber el b'nei Yisrael v'yichu li truma mi'et kol ish asher yidvenu libo tikhu et trumati. So Adonai spoke to Moshe saying, speak to the children of Israel that they may make me a contribution from every person whose heart makes them willing. Now, these people were just slaves, and suddenly they're being invited to do something willingly, generously, freely. God is inviting them into partnership. A whole new way of being, of human being, begins here, right? Begins with these people invited to build something. Until now, they were only building for their masters. Now they're building so that God, divinity, could live amongst them. And this Parsha starts again with that sense of empowerment of these former slaves taking action. Oil of olives, clear, beaten for the light, to draw a lamp wick regularly. Again, the verb for taking is used. The people who had nothing, who could give, build, contribute. And for what? What is this building project? In God's words from last week's Parsha, V'asuli mikdash, V'shachanti bitoham. Let them make me a sanctuary that I may dwell amongst them. God wants to be close to God's people in their midst, because no matter what they have done, no matter how much they complain, no matter how much they refuse to trust in God and God's promise, they are God's people. But here's something that's even more amazing to me.
Okay. Thank you.
God is asking the Israelites to be builders in the face of destruction. God already knows that this is the pattern of humanity, that whatever is built gets destroyed. God remembers what had happened with Adam and Eve. God remembers the flood. God knows that soon they will be worshiping a golden calf, and the tablets, the divine tablets that God gave Moshe, will be shattered. So the question is, for me right now, is how do we build in the face of destruction? And we know what will happen with this sanctuary. We know that it travels with the Israelites for 40 years. It goes with Joshua into the promised land. It's established in Shiloh. And although that destruction is not detailed, it's referred to in the book of Jeremiah that Shiloh was the first temple that was destroyed. In the days of Eli the prophet, around 11th century BCE. And then another temple was built. Another home for God was built by Solomon in the year 957 BC. And it's destroyed in the year 587 BC, and then another temple is built in the year 515 BCE, and it's destroyed in 70 CE. And yet, despite this history of destruction, we have become again and again builders, builders of cultures in foreign lands, and ultimately of a homeland. So I ask in this moment, in this terrible moment, how does one build in the face of destruction? How can we rebuild when we know that destruction is part of our story as Jews and part of the human story? That there is nothing we can build that is invincible. Nothing. Indeed, to build is eminently vulnerable. I feel funny even asking this question at this moment because we're in such a moment of grief. For the 1,200 people that were slain in the south of Israel on October 7th, for so much destruction, violation, and desecration, for the more than 100 hostages that are still in captivity, for the 200,000 people in Israel on the south and the north who are in exile from their homes, for all the soldiers that have been killed in Israel, which I think are currently estimated to be about 500. And for the more than 29,000 people who have been killed in Gaza, including thousands of civilians, women, and children, for the countless homes that have been destroyed there, for the 1.4 million people who are in exile from their homes. Most of these homes don't exist anymore, and they won't be able to return to them. Maybe in this moment of endless grief, it's not time yet to ask the question about building. Maybe it's not time yet for building. But here we are in these portions about building. So I wonder, what does it mean to build in the face of destruction? I read this amazing opinion piece on February 1st, some of you might have seen it, by a hostage that was released after 54 days. Her name is Liat Atsili. This was in the New York Times. She writes about the concept of tikuma, of rebirth, of rebuilding, of resilience. She was a hostage for 54 days. Her husband was murdered. Her three children, thank God, survived. Her home was destroyed. And despite her unspeakable loss, she writes a piece that's called Choosing Rebirth Over Revenge After My Release from Gaza. Where she found that in herself, I have no idea. She says, in Israel, the Shoah or Holocaust has often been spoken of in recent years alongside tikuma, meaning rebirth, after the survivor generation chose to rebuild a nation rather than lose itself to grief and vengeance. She continues, tikuma provides us with the vital life lesson of how to move on with dignity and purpose after experiencing a tragedy. And it is perhaps the most important gift that the survivors gave us. Beyond the horizon of our pain, we must recommit ourselves to tikuma with the same determined optimism of the Holocaust survivor generation. I see no alternative. Without tikuma, we will only sink further into the cycle of mutual anger and victimhood that has plagued our relationship with the Palestinians for far too long. This is not the approach that the survivor generation chose, and in their spirit, I do not seek revenge for what I have been through. She somehow found the courage, right, to believe in rebirth, right, to put a stake in the ground, hope. And I think it's so vulnerable to build, right, brick after brick, when we know that there's always the possibility of destruction. It's like living into the face of death, which we're always doing. right? There's always that threat. And how do we live so vulnerably, so openly exposed in the face of death? There's something in our Siddur that we often overlook. It describes God as Mechaye HaMeitim, the God that enlivens the dead, the God of rebirth, the God of resurrection. I'll never forget, years ago when I was a student, a friend of mine told me that she was an incest survivor, and that though that phrase about God was the most important description of God in the entire Siddur. Right, the one who resurrects the dead. So as we look around us and we see hints of spring, we remember that rebirth is possible and that there's something about spring, right? Those little green shoots that's so vulnerable, right? And to destroy in a way is so much easier, to sink into despair. But rebirth, rebuilding is calling to us from nature, from the Torah, from the fabric of our lives, from the cycles of nature. So maybe the sermon, after all, was all about the weather. It was about the fact that spring is coming, and that we can see fledgling, fragile signs of new life that somehow, I don't know how, have the courage to show themselves once again.
Thank you for listening. Want more content like this? Subscribe to our podcast and visit romamu.org to learn more about us. Please consider making a contribution to Romamu so we can continue to fulfill our mission to help spiritual seekers deepen their connection to Jewish wisdom and practice to help them become more compassionate human beings. We hope to see you in the synagogue or the Zoomagogue soon. Romamu. Romamu. Adonai.